This recording is made possible through the facilities of Howe Architecture Library, Arizona State University. Side 1. Paulo Soleri Lecture, December 17, 1971. 1 hour, 45 minutes.
Today it's my pleasure to introduce to you one of the, in my estimation, one of the rare men in the world who through his creative endeavors has become a phenomenon in his own lifetime. So if you would, please welcome Paulo Soleri. Okay.
Well, the first phenomenon is that I don't speak English, so that's going to be tough. And being the theory a little abstruse or a little difficult to present in 1 hour, especially for a non-speaking English person, I'm going to show the material first, and then we might get into a discussion, I hope. The material has two parts. One is construction and the other one is theory. The reason to show the construction is to demonstrate that we are also building and we are also living a normal life, so that you don't believe that or you don't think that we are only sitting on a desk coming up with strange ideas. So it's very important for you to go through the buildings first and then get acquainted with the concept and possibly develop a dialogue about the concepts. We are in Scottsdale, 5 miles north of Scottsdale, and many of you have been there probably, so you know more or less what we are doing. But you'll see some of the ways that we have been using to build very simple, very small structures that we are using for our purposes. Metal work, ceramics work, drafting, living, and so on. This compound has developed in the last 15 or so years, most of the buildings the last 10 years, in collaboration with the College of Architecture. We had summer workshops, and between 15 and 30 or 40 students used to come for 6 weeks and do some manual work there and discuss the ideas involved in it. In the last 3 years, we have been beginning the work on a new site, about 70 miles on Black Canyon Highway. And this is the site for Arcosanti, which is hopefully going to be a building for about 3,000 people involved in living, working, producing, playing, all under one roof. So it's a small town for about 3,000 people built on 10 acres, about 25 story high, occupying 1% of about 860 acres that we have. So it's going to be the opposite of a suburban development because the concentration of the activities will be very high and very purposely high and somehow centered around a small urban device, which would be a nucleus for some research on urban problems. So what we are going to do in the next 10 years, hopefully, is to experiment and to experience and to be the guinea pigs of a certain environment that we are devising and developing. So the main teaching process would be the learning about what we are doing, and the doing is going to be mostly building for many years. This is the place I was telling you we live and work in, and it developed very haphazardly. There was no plan as such. Every year we build some of the structures, or one or two of them. And then the year after we build something more to accommodate the activities The first experiment was this slab, which became a roof for a little house. And what I did, instead of slip casting ceramic pieces in the ground as I used to do, I slip cast somehow this slab on a mound made of soil. So this is the earth house, about 30 by 30 in the dimension. And the roof was cast on a mound of soil. After that came this studio, drafting and ceramics. Later on, this north studio, you see the entrance there. And then year by year, we enlarged the operation. We got into larger work in ceramics. We got into foundry work. We built another house for the apprentice. And lately we built a swimming pool, a canopy, and a larger drafting room. We are now stopping the building in this site because we are concentrating on a new site. This is the view of this structure from this side. Thank you. The work here is all done by young people and myself and my family, so there is no professional skills involved. This is a passageway coming through here. The view of this larger house from this side, the swimming pool, the canopy above the swimming pool, the little drafting room. Now I'm going to show some of the techniques that we used in building. This is the building, the construction of this here. Sorry. That what you see there is silt and has been packed on a form which is movable. You see it later. Those are some of the views still of the compound. This is the north studio looking into the ceramics area. The ceramics area where we do packing and casting in here. The courtyard of the larger house, the swimming pool area. The same courtyard. There you can see what kind of surfaces you get when you cast against the roughness of the soil. The little house, the first experiment, this was the roof, as I was telling you. And this is not an underground house, it's a ground which is a house which is below grade, but it has a large opening on the south, one on the north, and the skylights. I'm sorry about this business. The larger drafting room, a passageway going up into the cat cast, which is the larger house. Now you see this frame was movable, and we cast many of those sections, 11 of those, by moving the frame, assembly, putting up the silt, cutting into patterns, putting paper to obtain different colors inside of the shell, and pouring. Here you see the sections poured one by one, supported by the scaffolding. And then the last section had to be cast before the scaffolding came down. This is the keystone. And after that, you have the structure working in compression, so you take off the supports. This is the area, where we do the ceramics. We had a skylight in cardboard, and later on we made it into plastic and concrete. We are shaping a form here in soil again, to make this wall which contains the kiln for the ceramics. This is pure soil that has been packed, cut, worked. This is a coating of cement to stabilize in a way the pattern. Now we are pouring. There you see the wall itself, the shell, and this was the form that has been demolished afterwards. So we used soil for forming, but we used concrete for the structure itself. We were shaping a mound for a vault. It's a storage now. And this girl is cutting those ribs, and now we are pouring the concrete. Those again are sheets of, instead of paper, of cloth, plastic cloth, and you see the difference between the areas where the cloth is on and where it's not. The wet concrete picks up pigments and soil itself, so that you have a different color. This was one of the excavated shells. This is the preparation of another one using colors on the soil itself, stabilizing the color just before the casting of the shell itself, after the casting, before and after. This is a storage for the foundry area. We are building here an area, a space which is sheltered for the foundry work. By using this technique, we needed bulldozers to excavate under those shells, and the bulldozers cut deep trenches. So we landscaped those trenches by just cutting the soil and packing it. Later on, we stabilized them by pouring thin concrete shells. This is the resulting shell. We are building an enclosure for one of the patios in the large house. This is the little tunnel going down into the ceramics. In this case, we built three conical arches, one following the next, into a spherical shape. And then we concluded this structure by precasting an arch in silt and then assembling it. There you see the arch missing the keystone. This is the concrete shell. The silt has been washed away. The assembling of this arch. Those are the two final elements. And this is the keystone cast on the spot. So again, you get a compression stresses through the arch. We put a bench, a table, an awning, and a treehouse on top of it. It's a good viewpoint, sunset, for instance. We are casting the walls of the larger house, and we used gunite, or we cast by hand. This was still a solid mound of dirt. When you went in with the bulldozer, we excavated. This is the ceiling of this slab. We call it a cat cast because this shape was cut mainly by a bulldozer, a caterpillar. You see the roughness of the texture and the color of the soil. You see the glazing line. There are two light wells in the house. This is the glass line again. Those are railroad ties. Those are panels we built in the house as dividers for the small rooms. We are moving power poles to make supports for the canopy that is going to be sheltering the swimming pool. We have four foundations here, 12 poles. We are going to cast the slab and then raise it along those poles. This is the mold, the form for this casting. We are painting it. We are stabilizing the color. After the casting, we dug out the soil, and now we are raising it with two cranes. It's a 30 tons slab, and it went up quite easily. drying up dirt. You see the colors that come out by painting the soil instead of painting the shell itself. If you scrub this with the brush and water, you get more brilliant pigments, but I'd rather have them subdued that way. Now we are digging for the swimming pool. This was one of the few occasions when we had a crew of professionals, and the reason was that we wanted a very good surface for the purpose of cleaning the swimming pool, keeping the swimming pool clean. It became almost irresistible, that white inside egg. So it was Easter, I think, at the time, 4 years ago. So we got in and we messed it up. We were doing a fast job so that we would have a good binding between the white surface and the color, the chemical bond, like a fresco bond. The color were fairly fast. We had them for 4 years, and then last spring we got bad algae, and one of the boys put in too much chlorine, I'm afraid that was, so the color almost totally went in 2 days. We are precasting sticks of concrete by doing a slab and using dividers, metal dividers, and reinforcing those sticks with wire land, which is a number of strands of steel about an inch long and 10 mils in diameter. You throw them in a mixer and you get a diffuse strength, tensile strength within the structure. And after the curing, we assemble those into an apse. I call those structural apses, they are quarter of a sphere shaped. They have the peculiar quality of collecting the winter sun if they are exposed to the salt. So they become sun collectors, and it's very pleasant to work inside here. And in the summer they work as shades. So they somehow fit this climate, where in the winter you like to have the sunshine, and in the summer you really need shade for working. So this is an outdoor working area, fairly well set for this kind of climate, and we do the metal work here, the foundry work. This is, you see how we assemble those sticks. At the same time, we were building a very peculiar shape that is going to become a work area for model making. You see the making of this and the making of that together. We are still using some of those techniques on the new side, but in different ways and for different structures. What we are doing now is mostly precasting slabs, precast and then assembled. This was a mound of soil. We began the construction from the top, then we cast this layer, next was this. Now we are ready to cast this one, and we are going down the lower floor. And so that we end up by doing the footings the last, starting by the ceiling coming down into the footing. And in this case, the students put their own designs. This is paper cut and applied. And you can see this boy was putting up this pattern. This is the Nord studio. This is the largest drafting room. And it's almost completed now. So what we did, we bought flannel cloth, 3 feet wide. We dipped it in plaster. We hung this wet cloth on a frame that you don't see in the slide. And then when it was dry and stiff, we picked it up and assembled many of them on this scaffolding. So this is flannel cloth, form that is going to be visible inside is supporting the casting of the shell. This is the beginning of this process. We bought 4 sewer pipes, 10 tons apiece, we found out later on, when we started to move them by hand, and they frame the glazing. You see this sewer pipe, telephone poles and glass. Those are the ribs made in flannel. You see them in the process of being assembled and the final surface inside. Those work very well as little studios. We have a drafting room, a drafting table there, and a table on this side. And it's very pleasant as a space. Those are models you'll see later. Those are the arcologies models. We used to have one summer workshop, then we got into 5 or 6. Last year we had 11, beginning in March, ending a few weeks ago. And last summer we had 250 participants, plus the group that we have, and a more permanent group. So it was fairly large, and we poured more than 400 yards, I think, of concrete. We intend to do the same thing next year, but possibly have more people involved. And so the thing has been developing pretty well in the last 2 or 3 years. We have meetings, 1 or 2 meetings per week, with myself and the group. We support the foundation, the Kozani Foundation, that we have founded to support this work by making metal work and ceramics work. Mostly bells, wind bells, because they sell very well. We go from very small bells, a few dollars a piece, to groups of thousands of dollars a piece. I do some figures in styrofoam, like those things also made in styrofoam, and then we cast it in the lost styrofoam-like technique. This is aluminum now. I keep pushing the wrong button. We were asked by the Indian school in Santa Fe to build an outdoor theater using the same technique techniques we used in Scotia, because they liked the feeling of the structures. So here we are building this shell about the stage, and the staging goes on here, different levels on the bridge, on this runway also. This is the spectator bowl. The stage is 20 feet below ground level. We are preparing for the casting of those shells. This is the runway coming down. There you see the different texture, the soil, the wood, the embankment made of very rough aggregate. This is still the theater. The runway going into the stage area. I see what I'm doing. I'll go back for a moment. I tend to work in series. When I do something, I'll begin with one idea, and then I develop different ideas somehow around the same general concept. And this was the case for bridges, for instance. I made those models in a few weeks, and those were made in silt, and then what you see now is those models transferred into plaster. This was an earlier bridge. This is a tubular bridge. You see the background, some of the designs for a project of a 2 million population city. 2 million bridges. Sorry about that. This was a tubular structure also, but it has the advantage, let's say, of serving the two rims, but also serving the valley. So if you have, you can come up from this level up to this side of the valley or to that side, vice versa. That's the underside of it. Double cantilever bridge. The same one. This has been landscaped. Same one. A sketch for a one cantilever bridge and the model made after the sketch. This was a large a sketch for a large model that I made for the exhibit when it opened at the Corcoran. And this is the model, it's about 45 feet long. And it's a suspension bridge, but instead of having vertical pylons with the cables coming up and then going down into anchorages, doesn't have any anchorages, it just has one foundation, one on one side, one on the other one, and then those pylons are slanted, they come down, they're hinged here, so the weight of this pylon bounces the weight of the other one through the cable tension, and the roadway, in this case three-level roadway, is suspended from the cables. So it's a suspension bridge with only two points coming down into the ground instead of four. I began to be very much interested in urban problems when I got a grant from the Graham Foundation about 15 years ago, I guess. And I developed an idea for a 2 million population community. Some of the elements are pretty interesting now with the ecological almost fad that we have. And there was, for instance, a quarry along the axis of the city which was made into a man-made landscape. So this is an open pit mining, let's say, producing gravel and aggregate for building construction and roadways. And instead of leaving this scar, as we do most of the time, this was made into a park with its own little valley and sub-valleys and structure which were dug or cut or tunneled into it. So it's a geology which has been made into a man-made, man-shaped geology. Another element was that we had a belt here sunk into the ground, which was the recycling belt, taking all the rejects and waste of the city and coming up with raw materials or energy and so on. So you would be closing the cycle that we leave now open, which go for waste pollution and so on. There were many rings, one inside of the other one. The center was a learning center. Then there was a ring which was given to small industries and home industries. There was this larger belt for villages organized in townships. There was another belt which was mainly of marketing of standard produce. There was a theological center connected through this park to the learning center. This was still a very scattered kind of pattern. This is about 13 miles, I think. And it was from this, the inability to organize this space better, that I got into the three-dimensional concept. And this is the beginning of this three-dimensionality expressed very strongly. This is, I think, 150 floors or so. This was the learning center. This was a suggestion of this man-made landscape, geological center in here. Now we're getting into the more conceptual work. Those two sentences tend to synthesize the reasons for doing what I'm doing now in the last 3 or 4 years. The first one says that there is a direct relationship between liveliness and complexity. Things are more lively when they are more complex, and this can be checked within the biological universe constantly from the beginning of life to the present. The second sentence connects this idea of liveliness and complexity with the physical dimensions of the organism. Complexity is somehow coincidental with miniaturization. And the consequences of those two fairly simple statements is that if the city is an expression of liveliness, the city better be very complex and automatically very miniaturized. It might sound very strange, but we might try to get into this idea in a discussion. And at the end, I have some charts that might help a little to understand what I mean. This is one of the pages of the sketchbooks that I work with, indicating very roughly what this translates into. If you take this as a very diagrammatical scheme of a city in a section, vertical section, you see below the ground level the robotized aspect of society, which means the production and the service system for the life of a certain human group. And above ground you have the urban structure itself containing the private and the public sector of the life of this community. This includes living, working, producing, playing, and basically learning. So it contains the institutions that makes the urban life meaningful. In order to illustrate this concept, which is fairly simple, but it might suggest that once you accept the concept, you come out with, let's say, cubes and invade the earth with thousands of little or larger cubes containing cities. I developed about 40 different schemes just to illustrate the concept. So what you see from now on are very schematic, abstract symbols of urban ideas. There were some floating suggestions. This is one of those schemes. There are two main types of structures. One is the productive, the other one is the urban. This is the water level here. You have the harvesting of the sea, and you have the manipulation, the transformation, the processing of those produce into mineral, chemicals, proteins, who knows what, and then you have the storing and the shipping, research connected with them, and some of the urban life connected with this activity. You can cluster many of those in time and come up with a clustered system connected by those ribbons, which contain urban activities and the gardens and so on. Another scheme based on the same idea, floating again, is this one. You see the skeletal system somehow, this. And that again, this could develop from a small hub, which would be the original town, into a larger metropolitan area. If your structure is anchored to the continental shelf, let's say, you can have, again, production and service systems below water level and the urban life itself above water level or in contact with the open space. In this case, you can produce energy by using the tide because you have an anchored stable system working with a changing level of water. So if you have water reservoirs, you can fill them and empty it through the tide flows and produce some energy that way. One example of somehow of a dead or empty arcology, which is the name I'm using for the structure, is a dam. A dam is a massive block to the flow of water for purposes of energy production, water containment, irrigation, and recreation. We could add domestic uses of water and make this dead, dumb block of concrete into a living system. It would just be enough that when we plan a dam, we plan it as a porous or as a carved structure instead of being a dense and a monolithic structure. So this indicates one of those possibilities. On the outside, sorry, this is a section through here. On the inside wall of this double structure against the water, you have storage, warehousing, and some industries. On the outside wall, you have homes, let's say the private sector of the city, from homes to apartment housing. On the larger systems, which are part of the structure, also you can have production, marketing, learning, and so on. You can have heavy industries, power production, linear cities, carrying on with waterways and power lines. You have to keep in mind that on a dam site, you have everything already somehow there, from power to water, from recreation to farm possibilities. And then you have this massive and very expensive structure that somehow begs for life. Does the same schemes, same ideas with different structural schemes. This is a smaller one, this is a much larger one. Some of the example of the, again, as I was telling you, of symbols of urban centers are those two. This is about twice the height of the Empire State Building. So it's a very large structure, but it's a very, very small city. It's for about 500,000 or 400,000 people, I guess, suggested. The car naturally stops at the edge of the city. There is no room for cars inside of the city. Pedestrians are again part of the life of the city. You can reach everywhere within the city in a few minutes by walking, by elevators, by escalators, by moving sidewalks, etc., by bicycle, or who knows what. And you can also reach very quickly the outdoor, which is the real outdoor, is not the cluttered outdoor of the suburbia or the city park or so on. As for all the other ones, you have some kind of a accent of the private life on the dividing membrane between the cityscape and the landscape, so that your private life is set at the edge of both the cityscape and the landscape, which I think is very important. This was a scheme for, let's say, what you might call a twin city of about 1 million population. And keeping in mind that this dimension is no more than 2 miles, I think, you're still dealing with a system which allows you to communicate and transfer and transport things very swiftly and very efficiently. That means that you are cutting down the size of your server systems to a fraction of what we need now to keep things going. This goes for transportation, for health care, learning, policing, delivery, retrieval, and so on. So that you end up by seeing that miniaturization is not just a way of making things more economic, but it's an ethical aspect of how we are going to function, if we are going to function better than what we are doing now. Because we are going to cut into the drudgery, into the toil of society in a very substantial way. If you adopt the linear scheme, you can have main logistical systems cutting through a continent, for instance, and then plugged in to this system, which is shown in section here, all along the building, let's say. You can plug your urban structures, situating every city dweller very close to the urban institutions, to the land, open land, and to the main transportation system, including airports on the top of the whole system. If this was adopted, you would have to bridge obstacles. And this is an indication of, of a city bridge bridging a canyon. The same here, bridging a river. Those are all illustrated into the archaeology book, the MIT book. And as I was saying, there were attempts to illustrate the concept and show almost the limitless possibilities once you introduce the third dimension into your development of urban communities. Those are very schematic models of other ecologies. This is the same one, indicating the scale. This is the Empire State Building at the same scale. You see another one there, another one there. This is for 450,000 suggested population. This about 250, this 170,000. This is about 30,000. And this could be a farming community where the farmer can enjoy the urban life if he desires. So he can live there and go and farm, as many European farmers do, for instance. This is a cutout indicating what could be the city center life in many levels within some kind of conditioned space, so that if the climate outside is very harsh, you can have a better climate inside without sealing off the city completely. The same model. A larger scheme than this one. This is really a cluster of skyscrapers, but instead of being somehow segregated because they're only connected at the base, like we do now, they are desegregated structurally because they are connected at different levels. They are connected along the periphery and also radially. This indicates a modular system that you would be able to somehow shape according to your desires for your private environment. Sorry. Oh boy. Another scheme, a little smaller, about 170,000. In this one, we tried with the model to indicate this variety, this possibility of organizing spaces and structures in very different ways, somehow expressing the individual or the team or the corporation that would be involved in this life. This is the same one here that was indicated before. We have very large playgrounds and gardens, for instance, at this level. This was the most abstract and the most somehow the terrorizing one, and it was intentionally very abstract because I was trying to investigate how you can what you can do with a space with a solid, let's say, in this case a cube of 1 kilometer.